Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and see truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today we are talking about weight loss injections. And although this is a solo episode, I will be showing you several clips. It's like five or six clips from some of the medical doctors I have had on past episodes who are addressing the topic of weight loss injections. And I think this is a very important topic. It's very timely because so many people, I feel like half of the people I know, are either thinking of taking Ozempic or currently taking Ozempic. And first of all, nothing I say here today comes from a place of judgment. I don't care if you take Ozempic, but as a board certified health and wellness coach, I do feel obligated to point out that there are risks to that approach and there are much healthier and safer alternatives. So my goal today, along with sharing these clips, is for you by the end of this episode today, you'll know exactly what's at stake and really how to make the best decisions for your health. Because honestly, when you listen to what people are saying and when you read what people are saying about these weight loss injections, the benefits sound great. I mean, you're telling me I can lose all this weight that I've been trying to lose for years and all I have to do is show up to the doctor's office, get this injection, and I'm good to go. And that's not really telling the full story. And do those benefits even really hold up? Because honestly, when you actually look at who's funding this research, a lot of it's funded by the companies making these drugs. Novo Nordisk is one of the biggest influencers funding these research projects showing these amazing benefits of weight loss injections. And you don't have to take my word for it. You can go look for it yourself. Go to Google Scholar, type in Ozempic, look at some of the articles or some of the studies that show benefits, and go to the bottom, look at conflicts of interest or where is this study funded. You will see most likely Novo Nordisk, the company that makes Ozempic. So there is good reason to be suspicious of this research. And I mean, it's driven by pharmaceutical industry profit. But I do get frustrated at these companies to some extent because they're preying on vulnerable people who, in many cases, don't know any better. And there's just so much more that can be done that doesn't involve injections. Now, I am going to show the clips very shortly, but I do want to say a few more important things that I think will help set the scene for the clips ahead. First of all, some of the risks. So bone density loss. There was actually a viral video recently of a young girl who took Ozempic, presumably to lose weight, and she got osteoporosis and she was crying. She was devastated because now she has another affliction to deal with. Because what happens, and we talk about this in the clips ahead, but when you use these drugs, you stop eating, you stop getting calcium, and you basically make your body weaker in that sense, which can lead to osteoporosis. And not only weaker in terms of the bones, but the muscle as well, because you're not just losing body fat, you are losing some muscle, which is huge because as people get older, they might experience sarcopenia, which is muscle loss. And all of the health and longevity studies show that the more muscle you have on your body, the healthier and you will be and the longer you'll live. So there's more. There was ocular nerve damage that can lead to blindness, and there's pancreatitis. And if you look at the warning labels, they're egregious. Let me actually pop one on the screen right here. I saw this on social media. I was scrolling through. So if you're watching, let me show this ad here so you can see. Look at this warning. So this is for Mounjaro, as you can see. And it says this is an injectable medicine for adults with type 2 diabetes. And here we go at the bottom, warnings. Mounjaro may cause tumors in the thyroid, including thyroid cancer. Watch for possible symptoms such as lump or swelling in the neck, hoarseness, trouble swallowing, or shortness of breath. If you have any of these problems, tell your healthcare provider. Now, I don't know about you, but does that sound healthy? And I really mean that. Does that sound healthy? And the reason I ask that question specifically is because of how this problem of obesity or being overweight is framed. A lot of people come to me, they say, I want to lose weight. I want to lose weight. Well, let's look at how that's framed, because all these people, most of these people thinking about weight loss injections are coming from a place of self-loathing. I hate my body. I hate how I feel. Hate. I hate this. How productive do you think that mentality is, and how well do you think it is likely to serve you to come from this self-loathing perspective versus, hey, you know what? I actually love myself. And because I love myself, I don't want to take the risks of these injections. I actually, from a place of self-love, would rather nourish my body with healthy food and moving around and paying attention to my light environment and all the things that are actually influencing us to be in this uncomfortable state that we might be in. And look, it actually doesn't have to be that hard to lose weight. I know people are attracted to the weight loss injections because it's easy. I just get injected and I'm good to go. But there are much easier things that can be done. A lot of people think they have to grind in the gym and eat all these foods they don't like. It's actually not like that. So by the end of this episode, I think you will see that very clearly. So this first clip is the perfect place to start on this topic, I think. And it's with Dr. Amy Tiffany, who I've worked with in a professional capacity, who was kind enough to join us on the show and speak. The whole episode was about Ozempic, called Ozempic Culture. So we're going all the way back to episode 25. This is episode 25 with Dr. Amy Tiffany. And by the way, all the links to these episodes from these clips will be in the show notes. So if you want to explore it a little further and hear the full episode, you can check that in the show notes. Because even though with Dr. Tiffany, we spend the whole episode talking about weight loss injections, the rest of the speakers, we talk about numerous subjects, and I will make that clear between clips. But without further ado, let's start us off with the history of weight loss drugs with Dr. Amy Tiffany.
We have found the magic bullet, but the picture's a little bit bigger than what probably is being told. You've got a great point that these weight loss drugs are not new. They have been around for a long time, and some of them have been quite dangerous, frankly. The stimulant category of the medications, the amphetamines, many of the same things today that insurance companies require us to use even before injectable medications. These are medications that aren't friendly to the cardiovascular system. So the big difference in the injectable medications versus what we've had for decades is that semaglutide and these other medications are very friendly to the cardiovascular system and, in fact, have been shown to decrease major cardiovascular events, including heart attack and stroke. So there is benefit from these compared to the other, but I think your deeper question comes to, what is the treatment for obesity? Is medication the right thing to do or not? There's also an added layer with semaglutide specifically, because there's a lot of compounding pharmacies who are using semaglutide salts, which are not FDA approved. They're not the same thing at all. But the average person has no way to know that. And so that false marketing is also causing a lot of problems. And unfortunately, it is giving a new pathway into conflict here. There's a lot of people who say, well, can't you just eat less, move more? That solves the problem. And in a sense, I get what they're saying. Obesity is a disease, though. It's not an identity and it's not a willpower problem. There is nothing going wrong when obesity occurs, which is really not what most people think. They think this is a terrible process, that they're putting on weight, that their body's not working correctly, when in fact, their body's working exactly how it's supposed to. Our body is designed to use whatever calories and ingredients that it consumes to use it for energy. But anything extra is supposed to be stored as energy. And that's what obesity is. But it does tip into a actual clinical disease once it gets to be at a certain point. And everyone's body is different. I acknowledge that BMI is not perfect. It's all I have to use as a clinician right now. And those are the types of things that we have to make decisions on when it comes to injectable medication. They're actually approved only based on BMI. So recognizing the imperfections of the system, those are the constraints we have. And it comes back to your original question, is this the next greatest and best magic bullet? And it's not, especially if you look at the actual studies when these were done. These studies were predicated on the drug success based on lifestyle first. And that's what I don't hear anybody saying. And that's probably my biggest message I wish people understood. These were built on a calorie deficit, meaning the minimum amount of activity recommended by the CDC and oftentimes more. They had nutrition and access to registered dietitian coaches. They had one-on-one personalized training many times. And none of that is in our system and it's not in place for people to use. And so their default is, well, I thought I was moving more. I thought I was eating less. It failed. Therefore, I need a medication. And that's not the right answer. And so, you know, what I think about these injectable medications, they have tremendous capacity to improve quality of life. They have an ability to decrease potential costs by preventing and averting cardiovascular disease and stroke. But what if we never even had to be there? What if we never had to use the medication because our lifestyle actually set us up to not need the medication? And that's really what I'm passionate about in these medication discussions. I use them, and certainly they're appropriate for certain people. We do not use them aesthetically in my practice. There are certainly people who are doing that, but I do try to follow the clinical patterns as closely as I can based on the evidence that we have, and recognizing it's not perfect. It will change as well. The other thing that's not really, we don't totally understand it, first of all, but what we do understand is not being communicated. And that's when someone has developed clinical obesity and it's now a diagnosis, it's not just a pattern where I had some pounds shift back and forth, but we're talking about people whose BMI is 30, 35, 40 and higher. Once you've tipped into that disease state, the problem becomes your fat cells are programmed in our genetics that are they want to maintain their existence. And so it actually changes the hormone levels of leptin, and it affects the leptin and ghrelin work. Leptin is the hormone that's supposed to make us feel full. That's one of the things that they're capitalizing on when they're talking about how this makes you not hungry. There's also, ghrelin is the hormone that makes us feel hungry. And so there's also a spectrum here that we're evolving in our understanding of, and trying to figure out how does this play in, and how much are these drugs affecting that process versus the brain? And there's a whole different spectrum of brain-related eating disorders that come into this as well. And I imagine most of your listeners are familiar, for example, with anorexia or perhaps bulimia and binge purge disorder. But there's a different one that I actually find to be incredibly common, and I don't have the understanding of why we're seeing this much more, unless it's just that we're looking for it right now. But it's one of the main reasons I find people, especially women, are not able to lose weight. It's a disease called binge eating disorder. It's totally different than bulimia. And in binge eating disorder, similar to the question you raised earlier about serotonin, the problem here is dopamine in the brain. And there's only certain ways to get that dopamine leveled off so that you stop thinking of food. And in fact, that's what I frequently hear people say is the noise in my head about the food has stopped. One woman even told me, she's like, is this what normal people feel? And so you've got that whole thing complicating this as well, and trying to understand what's actual physiology, what's pathologic, what is something that is a marketing scheme and it's a fad that we may find like FinVin is dangerous. You know, those are all things that we don't completely understand. We think we do, and we certainly articulate to the best we understand, but there's a lot of gaps here.
Definitely. And some of the problems have already started to present themselves. I know Ozempic face is a headline that circulated. And then you look into that a little bit further and you find that it's cutting down on muscle in some instances, as well as the fat, which that's not something I know very in depth. But when I hear that sort of thing, that sounds like a red flag to me, because we know as we think about health and longevity, especially as we get older, we start to lose more muscle. Muscle is important for health and longevity. We want as much muscle as we can really hold on for as long as we can. And so I wonder about the effect of introducing this foreign synthetic drug that has this mm-hmm. effect that leads to the muscle wasting on some level. Mm-hmm. Is that something that these people should maybe be concerned about?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And it's one of these very gray areas still. I would say, you know, if I have 100 people that I've prescribed Ozempic to, I'm not hearing very much about either of those problems. And I will acknowledge my population's a little bit different than perhaps many other populations. They're very literate, very health aware, very health conscious. And I would imagine if that was happening with most of them, I'd be hearing a lot more noise about it. I certainly hear the complaints on other medications. I do think these are real problems, though, for the people it's affecting. And I don't think people are making this up when it comes to feeling the muscle loss or the wasting or the weakness. One of the primary things I see that contributes to that, though, is that when people don't feel hungry, they really do stop eating. And one of the things I have to drill into my patient is you have to keep eating with these medications. It's not that you're never going to feel hungry and therefore you don't eat. And they say, oh, yeah, I know that. But then they don't eat. And you have to maintain a certain amount of eating or you're effectively starving your body, which is then going to do exactly what you described. It's going to start using its energy sources, which it's supposed to do. And some of those, in fact, do cause systemic problems.
So it sounds like in some cases, you could just be trading one problem for another. I have obesity, so let me trade it for not eating. And then you have a whole other thing to deal with. But even further, I know one of the lawsuits that I saw, separate from Ozempic face, there was a lawsuit that recently was put out there where I think there was GI problems, some sort of complications.
Yeah.
And so that's one incident, one lawsuit. You know, it's hard to sort of extrapolate that out further.
Yeah.
But let's say just for the sake of argument that even in such a short term, we're seeing these types of problems. I wonder about long term, like when you introduce or when you modify a natural mechanism in an unnatural way, I just wonder about the long-term implications of that. And I would guess we don't have many long-term studies on this, given how recently and new it's kind of been on the market. In a sense, with many drugs, we are the long-term studies when they put that out there into the market. So as far as you can tell, do you foresee any kind of long-term complications maybe developing with this sort of thing?
Yeah, that's a really great question. I worry a lot about people's bone health. I worry that they're not getting the nutrients that they need and that they're going to start losing bone mass, particularly my women who are midlife and older. They already lose estrogen. Guys are different. They're lucky. They keep producing testosterone throughout their life. But women lose their estrogen once their ovaries either stop working or are removed. And in the absence of giving them hormones, their bones suffer. So now we've already got that. We have potentially a hit with medication because many people in midlife do gain weight, and that is a time in life where it's very frequent to see these medications used. I do think we're going to see a lot of information coming out from the consumers, and I suspect it will be very different from what we see from the pharmaceutical company and industry. What that industry and that group is going to want to make sure we hear, because they know we're already hearing the consumer side. They're going to want to know and make sure that we understand, hey, these are preventing heart attacks, they're preventing strokes. And we can't just look at the short term. We have to look at the long term. But within the long term, we have to balance which one's worse. What's the worst evil? Is it worse to have your stomach have different changes in its absorption, or is it worse to have a heart attack? And that's the type of thing I think we're going to hear a lot more about in the scientific community. I think we're going to hear a lot more about what has been gained versus what has lost. Whereas in the consumer industry, these are real people. They're experiencing these real side effects. I did see the lawsuit that you're referencing, and she talked about how she didn't feel properly informed about the risk of gastroparesis. And there's a lot of confounding there, so I can't comment to her case specifically. You know, it is true that diabetes itself leads to gastroparesis for some individuals. However, that tends to be poorly controlled long-standing diabetes. It is true that medication can cause side effects. And I frequently tell my patients, listen, any side effect you can imagine up to and including death is possible, right? Any medicine can cause any problem at any time. And so that definitely is a concern. And from a long-term perspective, I think we're going to hear from the science community, we've proven that this prevents heart attacks and strokes. Maybe it prevents dementia. Maybe it prevents fatty liver disease. Maybe it improves fertility, but those types of studies aren't going to come out very quickly. It's going to be over time. And that's the frustrating thing that I face, because people hear these very real concerns, and for good reason, they are hesitant to take a medication. The truth is, most people that I work with, though, are trying to reverse disease and not take medication. So they're not real interested in taking medication at baseline, but for other people, I mean, I've had family members that these medications have given them their life back because they've finally been able to lose enough weight that they can then go move and do the exercise and activity. The question is it sustainable? And that's really the crux of what we have to worry about long term, is as soon as I take someone off these medicines, if they haven't had the lifestyle change and the baseline change in behavior, everything's coming back because that's just pure physiology. And that is my biggest frustration long-term that people aren't hearing and aren't talking about is what is our plan for when we stop the medication? In Europe, you can only use it for 2 years. What's going to happen in the United States? I don't know. But only about a third of people even have access to the medication unless they're going to pay out of pocket. And of those people who are taking the medication, we suspect that there's going to be term limits on how long they can use it. And that's a concern from the perspective of chronic disease management, because chronic diseases, unless lifestyle has changed, and I am talking about lifestyle-induced chronic diseases. But if you don't change that underlying problem, they are going to come back. And then you haven't gained anything. You potentially hurt someone pretty badly.
All right. So weight loss drugs aren't exactly new, and doctors have been prescribing them for decades. But if history tells us anything, it's that they tend to come with some pretty serious consequences that show up only later. But how do these new weight loss injections actually work? And what's the catch? So next, Dr. Charles Glassman, also known as Coach MD, is here to really break it down for us how they work. And again, the episode will be in the show notes. This one is from episode 53, titled Challenging Conventional Healthcare with Dr. Charles Glassman. So here we go. Let's talk a little bit about how they work.
So these medications have been around a long time, at least 10 years. And they were derived as glucagon-like peptide 1 agonists. So it acts like glucagon, like the glucagon molecule. And glucagon is a molecule in the, it tells you that it's enough, that you've had enough. And so it does two things. It tells you, sends a signal to the brain for that. It also stops the stomach from emptying. So the stomach feels full. These were derived from studies done on the Gila monster in the desert, because the Gila monster only eats once a year or so. And so the rest of the year can't be hungry. So it's derived from the saliva of the Gila monster. So they've been around, and Byetta, I think, was one of the first, and they were like once a week medications, injections. And for the most part, they cause with my patients a lot of nausea, a lot of just not feeling well. I guess the newer ones have lesser immediate side effects, but you have to understand what we're doing here. It's, as I mentioned, the two biggest factors that drive people to doctor's offices are stress, emotions, behavioral health, mental health, and lifestyle choices. And the lifestyle choices, for the most part, have gotten us in the situation if we need to take Ozempic and that sort of thing. So it's a fix that once you start injecting yourself with that, you will lose weight. And that's very seductive. But what kind of weight are you losing? You're not only losing fat, but you're losing a lot of muscle. And as we get older, muscle health is extraordinarily important. In fact, there was just a study that was coming out about hip fractures, and the death due to hip fractures is greater than cancer deaths. And that's because people have not, as you get older, you lose muscle mass. And so taking these medications will make you lose weight, but you're going to be on them forever, because unless you do the work and unless you figure out why you became and were put in that situation in the first place, then you're going to gain it back. It's the same thing with bariatric surgery. I'd say 60 to 80% of my patients gain their weight back and more after bariatric surgery. And I'd say 80%, the majority of my patients over the years. And I know that if you really look at true studies, you'll find that. Now, what really bothers me about this movement with Ozempic, and again, like you said, not the devil, there are certain places for it. It was first only for diabetics. Now you're getting a lot of studies with confirmation bias. And so the confirmation bias means that the doctors already have the researchers already have the result of their study in mind when they form the study. And so you're seeing so many studies now that it's good for general aging, living longer, congestive heart failure, hypertension, yes, diabetes, we've known that, that's what they were prescribed for. But the real danger is that, again, if you don't do the work, you're going to be on these medications and for a long time. And if you look at the warnings, the warning is that they can cause certain types of cancer. The type of pancreatic cancer that Steve Jobs died from is the type of cancer that's within the warnings of these medications. I'm not saying that if you take them, you're going to get that cancer. But like you said, we're the study, we're the experiment. Okay. I'm not anti these medications, but they really shouldn't be used in mass. And then when you get all these, it's laughable to me, because I know that, like, for instance, the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA, they're funded by the pharmaceutical industries. Every single, and again, I'm not anti-pharma, but you just have to look at the reality, okay? The doctors who are doing this research, they have to be tenured. They have to get, they have mortgages, they have families, they have to be tenured by the institutions. So if there's something that's very popular, they're going to have studies and be funded to run those studies. But if you start getting very negative, if you start, you can't laugh at gift. You can't, something a gift horse in the mouth.
You can't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Right, exactly. So if you're being gifted these stipends or these grants by the companies that are helping you with the research, and you start coming up with stuff that's showing that they're terrible, I mean, that's going to dry up pretty quickly. So again, people are people. They have mortgages to pay. They have families to feed. They have the tenured spots to maintain and to bring in money to this, you know. So anyway, you got to be very careful with the choices. They do work. And if you want to help them help you, then you have to do the work. We're leaving a big piece out of this, and that's physical fitness. And you take physical fitness, you talk about cognition. The best thing that you can do for cognition is physical fitness. And all the studies show that. And you don't need the studies to show. You just need to take people who are aging, who are physically fit, and they're sharper, you know. So, but anyway, getting back to the Ozempics, the Mounjaros, the Wegovys, these are medications that have to be used thoughtfully, mindfully, and are not just these weight loss clinics that are popping up in the online. It's a big, big business now. And don't be a sucker. Don't be seduced into that quick fix. And if you are, do it not in a manipulative, not being manipulated or seduced, but you being in control and deciding, yes, I'm using this as a vehicle to get me started, and then I'm going to take over from there.
Okay, so now we know a little bit more about how these drugs work. They slow digestion, they suppress appetite, and yes, they do cause weight loss. But at what cost? One of the biggest concerns is muscle loss, like I mentioned in the beginning. And that muscle loss can really set you up for some long-term problems like osteoporosis and metabolic dysfunction. And honestly, beyond the health risks, if you think about it, if these drugs actually solved the problem of obesity for good, wouldn't that be bad for business? It just doesn't make sense as a business model. And I do want to say, before we get into the next clip, if you specifically have been struggling with your weight and you feel like there's something blocking you or holding you back from making progress, I help people with exactly that. And I want to help you break through those obstacles. That's actually what I do in my brand new 3-month coaching program, specifically for people who are trying to lose weight and thinking about or taking weight loss injections. Because really, when you think about it, you already know what you should be doing, at least some of the things, like eating better and moving more. But the real challenge is actually figuring out why you haven't been able to stick with it. What are those roadblocks? And that's where I come in as the board certified health and wellness coach, who has over 130 5-star reviews on my website from Google, as well as several video testimonials. So if you click the link in the show notes or go to mikevera.com, you can book your $1 first session so we can actually meet face-to-face and we can start removing those roadblocks right away and actually get you results. But in this next clip, I actually speak with Dr. Sean Baker, who is well-known in the carnivore diet space. He's a best-selling author with a book on carnivore. He's been on Joe Rogan. I think he has 1 million followers, or almost, maybe 500,000. And of course, he's a medical doctor, so he knows his stuff here, and he's going to tell us a little bit about the pharmaceutical industry's role in all of this, as well as some of the long-term risks. Oh, and by the way, this is from episode 57, Carnivore Diet with Dr. Sean Baker.
I don't think the solution to the obesity epidemic, I don't think the solution for the chronic disease epidemic is going to be more drugs. I mean, I just don't think. And again, you think about how these drugs are manufactured and designed. They are designed to be taken for the rest of your life. I mean, this is a pharmaceutical model. It's not to cure disease. It's not to eradicate disease or decrease the incidence. It's just to keep more people medicated chronically for the rest of their life for recurring revenue. And so this is Ozempic's another one. And I know there's physician champions and people jumping up and down because they're seeing some people lose some weight on this for the first time in maybe many, many years. And undoubtedly, there's going to be some people that will lose weight with this. Some of them will be able to keep it off. I think the majority, if you do not address the underlying issue, the addictive issues, the overall nutrition quality, it's not going to work long term, I think, for most people. I think some of the problems with the drug, like you mentioned, it's a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And so what is GLP-1? GLP-1 is an incretin hormone, which is, it modulates our gut function, right? And so the way it normally works in our body, so GLP-1 is secreted by something called the L cell, like the letter L in the ileum, which is the end of our small intestine. What happens is normally, and there's this concept called the ileal break. And what happens is as nutrition sort of winds its way through the intestine and gets to the very end, and these cells start sensing nutrition, if there's too much, they say, wait a minute, this nutrition is not getting absorbed. Slow things down so we can start absorbing everything. And meat, it's particularly potent. Beef isolate very potently stimulates GLP-1 because when we eat a steak, our gut does slow down because we want to absorb all that nutrition. But you think about it. When's the last time you saw a hunk of meat floating in the toilet? This doesn't occur, right? Never, because it's all absorbed. Now, you contrast that to fibrous vegetables. Yeah. I mean, corn, and I mean, it's kind of gross, but you see this stuff in your feces. So GLP-1 is supposed to hang around for about 5 minutes. It's supposed to be, it stimulates, it does its job, slows things down, and it goes away. When you take the injections, it hangs around in your body for days and days on end. So that's why people have these side effects of intestinal obstructions, gastroparesis. Sometimes it's gut paralysis of the stomach. Sometimes that's permanent for some people. And then, like I said, a lot of people will say they have these awful burps because they got this food that's sitting in their gut and just rotting in their stomach. It's not getting passed through. And it's just like there's a dead animal inside them. It's like awful. So we get some of these side effects. The other thing around that is there's some evidence that it leads to what's called fat cell hyperplasia, which means that your fat cells get smaller, but there's more of them. And so as long as you're on the drug, you keep these small fat cells. But guess what happens when you go off the drug? Now you have more fat cells than you started with. And so you'll start seeing more and more weight gain. And so I think what we'll see, and this is what I would, again, I've mentioned this before. When I was training to be a doctor and a surgeon, one of the guys said, never be the first guy. Don't be the first guy to jump on a trend because you're going to get burned. Don't be the last guy, but don't be the first guy. And I think a lot of these people, these early adopters of this, yeah, there's a lot of people wanting this. They can make a lot of money. It's a quick buck. You can make a quick buck. Open a little Ozempic clinic and you can make $1 million in a year and yeah, life is good. But the problem with that is, you know, you're going to start seeing probably, my prediction is probably, I don't know, 5-10 years from now, those drugs will no longer be in vogue. There'll be too many side effects. There's already class action lawsuits that are developing that they're going to sue. Let's say it's a super wonderful drug that from the pharmaceutical standpoint, and they sell it to 700 million people. 1/10 of the Earth's population goes on this drug. That would be like the pharmaceutical's wet dream. Probably of that 700 million people, there's probably going to be 1 million or more people that are going to have like significant, serious complications like thyroid cancer, pancreatic cancer, gut paralysis, bowel obstruction, suicide, things like that. And they'll we'll pay a $4 billion fine, $5 billion fine. They take it out of their change drawer. That's already built into the cost of doing business there. Because this drug will sell $500 billion, maybe $1 trillion when it's all said and done. And maybe it'll get pulled from the market, maybe it'll fall out of vogue, but then it'll be onto the next drug by then. They'll be onto the next iteration. Maybe they'll do some gene editing or whatever. We're going to go to that. But again, ultimately, I just don't think that's the solution. I just don't think you can fix a nutrition problem without fixing the nutrition. And I think that's really where we're at.
You know, Dr. Baker makes a great point. These drugs are designed to be taken for life. That's actually the business model, not a cure. But here's something most people don't realize. When you actually take these injections away, your body notices that and it adapts, and not in a good way. There very well could be this rebound effect where, because you've been artificially suppressing your appetite for so long, that it kind of goes in the other direction when these weight loss injections are gone. So you might find yourself voracious and uncontrollably hungry, which is certainly not what we want. And that would mean basically we've put ourselves in a position where we need these weight loss injections for the rest of our life. And I don't think anyone wants to need injections for the rest of their life. So up next, Dr. John Catanzaro is going to explain how these drugs can really interfere with your body's natural hormones and create more long-term problems that you just can't undo. And this is from episode 55, Personalized Medicine and Peptides with Dr. John Catanzaro. So here we go. I've talked to other doctors in the past about things like Ozempic. And one of the concerns I expressed was something like, if you're taking Ozempic for some period of time, we know that those peptides are naturally in the body, and the logic, the way it's sold to us, is basically, hey, you know, it's natural. We're just modulating this natural sort of thing in the body. But then the doctors tell you, you basically have to take this forever. Right? Literally, the people I work with have told me, their doctors have told them that. And it makes me think that if they introduce this foreign peptide like Ozempic in the first place, that when they stop taking it, it's maybe going to downregulate their own natural peptides. And is that actually a concern? And if so, how are the ones you're talking about different, if at all?
Well, I mean, that was very well thought out, because when you think about it, the body, if it's exposed to a certain type of drug, whether it's a peptide or any type of a drug, the body can develop a resistance to that drug over time, right? And these peptides, these receptors can be attacked by antibodies and blocked by antibodies by the very action of creating a resistance to the drug itself. So in other words, a drug comes in, you have to raise the threshold up. The body sees that this concentration is going up, so therefore it starts to identify friend and foe. So then it starts seeing the drug as a foe, and it starts seeing it as, I don't like this. We're going to have to get rid of it. So the detoxification pathways and protection pathways kick in. And then that's when you can have unfavorable shifts like autoimmune expression to the pancreas, where you end up having your GLP-1 and your GIP and some other IGFs and other very crucial signaling type of hormonal peptides affected, to where you can have a failure, if you will. And that's the reason why we see some of the warnings of, when you're using these weight loss peptides, you have to be aware of pancreatitis, you have to be aware of possible liver toxicity, you have to be aware of possible gastric issues like gastroparesis and things like that, because the signaling, now we're talking about the effect of the signaling, the hormonal signaling of the GI tract is involved, right? So, and that usually happens when the drug starts wearing out its welcome. And here's the other thing, is if you look at GLP-1 and you look at the structure of GLP-1, it's not just a simple peptide. It's actually a bridged, sophisticated, greasy molecule. I usually say greasy molecule. It's like, from a standpoint of, it doesn't really operate cleanly in the body. It actually is a very sloppy acting type of drug. And there's a lot of different drugs out there that are very sloppy in their structures. And what's the reason for this? Well, fast development, not looking at personalized structures from a standpoint of how it's going to be affecting the individual. Personalized structures are going to be much more, I would say, safe from the standpoint that you're looking at how they align with the body tissues, how do they align with the person's own immune expression, how they align with the targets, how do they align? They're not just taking one single target, focusing on it, burning it out, and then that's it. You wear out your welcome, and then probably can't use the drug anymore after that, or you have to couple it with another drug, right, to have a similar effect. And I'll tell you what, I've been on the other side of hearing many stories, because many patients would come up to me or even people that I talk with that they want to know my advice. And they're saying, hey, my brother wound up in the emergency room with a severe block intestine. What happened there? I mean, he was fine until he started these weight loss drugs,
right?
And the thing is that the conclusion that they would come to in the emergency room is that we have to stop the medication because it's the medication that actually caused the signal interference and has created the off-target toxicity. So, look, I agree with you. I think that there's a point where we have to assess and say, okay, so you have these tools. We want to use these tools intelligently. And I can use my own personal life as an example. Like, I was 38 pounds overweight and I didn't want to go on any weight loss drugs. So what do I do? Is I, you know, my wife and I do Pilates, the reformer Pilates every day. I really toned down my calorie intake and focused in on more live foods. Live foods is the focus. And I wind up pulling off 36 pounds in a period of 9 weeks. Yeah. Right. Without any weight loss drugs. Now, I get it that sometimes you need to have a little bit of help. But like you were saying, it's really important to realize that if you go the medication route, you're right. If you go off the medication, then the body goes back to its old reflexes because you really didn't change the dynamic expression at all. The targets that were still resistant when you started are the same. It's the same situation that's there. When you go off the medication, it's going to reflex back to that type of activity, unless you change the molecular moiety, if you will, right? And you have a whole lot of help from the outside just with your changes that you make in your diet, the changes you make in your exercise, your mental outlook, your spiritual outlook, all of those things are really important.
All right, so now we can see the biological risks of taking these weight loss injections. Your body really starts depending on these drugs, and stopping them could make things worse. But what about the argument that these drugs might have other benefits? Some studies suggest that they could help with metabolic disease, food addiction, and even longevity. Well, Dr. Robert Lufkin is up next with a more nuanced take, and he'll explain where these drugs might have some potential, but why they are still not a real solution on their own. And this is actually why my coaching program exists. So if you're tired of feeling stuck and relying on outside solutions that don't actually fix the problem, of course, there's a better way. And if you do show up for that first $1 session in our time together, we'll uncover exactly what's been holding you back in the session. Day one, I want to offer you as much help as I possibly can. And in the program, we use the best tools and resources to really help you create lasting change. I mean, really game-changing things that most people miss when it comes to weight loss. And it's all designed around you and your specific challenges. So if you are interested, make sure to go to mikevera.com or check out the link in the show notes to book your $1 session so we can get started. But now let's get into this clip with Dr. Robert Lufkin, who is a New York Times best-selling author. He was in an earlier episode too. He was on the show twice, but he came back for episode 63, Lies I Taught in Medical School. Dr. Lufkin exposes the truth, round two. That is the episode, which, as always, will be in the show notes. But here we go, Dr. Robert Lufkin on a nuanced take around weight loss injections.
Even more interestingly is these GLP-1 agonists that, you know, it's a new class of peptides. We've been hearing about them, things like Ozempic or, you know, semaglutide is one group, tirzepatide is another one. And then there are, you know, numerous brand names. They were originally developed as an injection for obesity, and they work. You know, people lose weight on these. And it was thought they do work by creating a sense of satiety, decreasing gastric emptying, and slowing down the GI tract a little bit, which works. But then people noticed, and interestingly, they were given to obese people, and it lowered their risk of not only they lost weight, but they also improved their diabetes, cardiovascular disease, even Alzheimer's disease. Now all the way across the metabolic spectrum. But people are saying, well, you know, if you take any obese person, obesity itself is a risk factor for, you know, obesity is now replacing tobacco as the number one environmental risk factor for cancer, you know, and And it's also, you know, heart disease, all of the metabolic diseases, even mental illness, obesity is a huge factor. So if you just get people to lose weight, they're going to improve all those. Fair enough. But then they started figuring out if you take people who aren't overweight, start giving them these GLP-1 agonists, like type 2 diabetics who aren't overweight, they actually can reverse their type 2 diabetes. Now it's FDA approved for that. And then they're still having these downstream effects. And what they're figuring out is it's not just that these drugs just don't work on the stomach, but they also work on the brain. And they decrease neuroinflammation. And people talk about, well, it changed my relationship with food. So it's not that I just feel full. I don't want to eat the junk food anymore or any kind of food. But then it goes beyond that. Some people report, wow, it changed my relationship with alcohol. So I don't want to drink anymore. It changed my relationship with cigarettes. It changed my relationship with other addictive behaviors. So people are starting to, you know, look at GLP-1 agonists for, you know, many, many different metabolic causes, including, you know, junk food addiction at some level. It can be very powerful, but it should never be. People are saying, well, you know, you say, Dr. Luffy, you say pills and surgery don't work, you know, lifestyle works. Now you're saying what, GLP-1s work on metabolic disease? Well, they only work if you change your lifestyle. In other words, if you're obese and you're fat and you take a GLP-1 agonist, you're eating a lot of junk food, you will eat less junk food and you will lose weight, but you'll be thin and metabolically unhealthy. So, and you may not get off the GLP-1s. You'll be on them for life and you may have sunken eyes. And, you know, we've all seen the GLP-1 faces. But if you combine these powerful drugs with lifestyle, things like that you're doing in your program, things like exercise, specifically strength training, and also nutrition, specifically protein, then we save our muscles, we change our lifestyle, and then we can taper off the drugs, and our lifestyle is really what's driving us eventually long term.
So yes, it seems that there are some possible metabolic benefits, but only if you're also making the lifestyle changes. And quite honestly, that's the part that is really missing from a lot of the conversations around these weight loss drugs. I have people who come to me for the first time and they're already taking these weight loss drugs. And I ask them, like, what did your doctor help you with when it comes to lifestyle aspects of this? And the answer is usually nothing at all. But remember all the risks we discussed earlier. Even if you're losing fat on these drugs, you're also losing muscle, which is the last thing that you want for long-term health. And that goes back to this idea of framing the problem wrong. Do I want to lose weight or do I want to be healthy? Because if I want to lose weight, well, I can cut off my limbs and I've lost a lot of weight instantly. But obviously that's not healthy. And I think that highlights the problem with framing this issue wrong, like focused on weight loss. You're chasing numbers. It's not healthy. It feels restrictive. You might do unhealthy things together. Like, I know people who don't eat for days to try to lose weight. It's like, is that healthy? Is that the healthiest approach? Is that sustainable? Do you feel unrestricted or do you feel restricted? So again, I go back to framing this correctly. Instead of, I want to lose weight, how do you think things would be different if you said, I want to be healthy? And that's actually what we're going to discuss in this next and final clip, bringing it right back around with Dr. Amy Tiffany again, who opened the show with the first clip. And she's going to help us really wrap things up with some crucial advice on some of the healthier approaches for those who might be taking or thinking of taking weight loss injections, advice on bone health, nutrition, and what people taking these injections need to know before it's too light.
Well, let's assume somebody is taking them, because of course, many people are. You mentioned that bone health is a possible concern. So what could somebody do to mitigate against those risks?
Yeah. So there's a few things. And just in general, common good bone health practices are going to be doing weight bearing activities. And that does not necessarily mean to be lifting weights, although that is one way to do it. One of the easiest ways for the spine, the hips, the femur or thigh bone, those types of bones, is just walking. Anything that causes the heel to strike the ground is going to be helpful. And so you're thinking about walking, running, skipping, jumping rope. All of those types of activities will help strengthen the bone. And that's because bones are in a natural and normal up and down, building up and tearing down process to keep them strong. So if they're not having any type of resistance they have to work against, they're not going to maintain their strength. Especially in our postmenopausal women, even our men, as they get older into their 70s and 80s, if they're not doing those weight-bearing activities against gravity, in other words, they're going to lose bone mass. So that is one thing that I can't emphasize enough. It's not just the cardiovascular activity, the cardio that we need to be doing. It's also the weight-bearing activity, the resistance activity, the strength training. You know, you think about the different activities that people frequently do, spinning or the swimming. These are not going to help your bones. They're going to help your heart. They're going to help your muscles. They're going to help the flexibility, but they're not actually improving bone mass because they're not against gravity. And that's a really key concept I find people don't understand very much. The other thing that I hear quite a bit about is the idea of calcium, and I need to take more calcium in. And if you're eating a healthy diet, you're getting your calcium through your fruits and vegetables. If you, even if you don't drink dairy, almond milk, some of these plant milks have a ton of calcium. So I actually don't generally find that people need supplemental calcium. There are calcium calculators online that they can go and type in their general average diet and see what they get. And there are different calcium recommendations for different ages and genders and whatnot. But most people don't need a calcium supplement. What they do need is vitamin D. At least in North America, we're not getting a whole lot of vitamin D. And one of the biggest misconceptions I hear almost every week, especially in the summertime, is, well, I go outside, and so I'm getting my vitamin D through the sun. Well, first of all, you're in North America, so you're not getting as much vitamin D as you think. And second of all, if you're wearing sunscreen, you're blocking 95% of that vitamin D absorption. And so we're not as well vitamin D sufficient as most people think. And it's actually more common that I find people who are low, sometimes severely low in vitamin D. And that's going to impact your bones, because if you don't have vitamin D, you can't absorb calcium. And if you don't have enough magnesium, your calcium levels it's not going to work correctly. So just those two things, being active and eating the right types of food to get the right nutrients in our body and taking a vitamin D supplement are key strategies to keeping the bones strong. For the person who's on Ozempic or any of the similar drugs, it's even more crucial that they're doing these things and being very intentional. But to your point, most people aren't even doing activity. So it's a real frustration that I don't see resolving quickly. But I'm hoping that through efforts like yourself and getting the message to people of what really needs to be done, that they can start owning their health and really take back the true health care we should have instead of the sick care system we currently have.
Definitely. And next, I do want to shift into that sick care system. But just out of curiosity, what happens in the body that makes you concerned about bone health as somebody takes something like Ozempic?
The biggest thing is that you're not eating the right nutrients. And so if you're taking Ozempic, you're not going to feel hungry. If you do eat something, it's often not the minimum amount of fruits and vegetables a day we recommend is at least 5. I'd love it if everyone ate 10 servings. And that's something we should be teaching in grade school. What is a serving? How do you know what the right amount is? And when can I figure out if I'm eating enough berries or enough citrus or enough dark green vegetables? Because nobody knows. We haven't taught them. So my concern is people think they're doing the right thing, and they're not. They're sabotaging themselves.
All right. So what's the big takeaway? I think it's that weight loss drugs don't fix the real problem. If you don't remove your obstacle standing in your way, you're just going to be stuck in another vicious cycle, whether it's with medications, fad diets, or programs that don't actually help you follow through. Again, this is exactly why I created my 3-month program, which is very different from everything else that's out there. I've been doing this for a long time. I know what works and I know what doesn't. It's not about telling you what to do. It's not you show up and I give you a workout plan and I tell you that you're doing everything wrong with your food and here's what you need to do instead. Now get out of here and go do that. That's not
at all what it is. This is a coaching program where not only do I give you the resources and the tools, and we work with you one-on-one for the accountability, the support, answering questions. I am here to help you get that transformation for good, because your health should never be controlled by a prescription. Let's actually take back control the right way, and in a way that is customized to you specifically. So for the final time, go to mikevera.com or click the link in the show notes to grab your $1 first health coaching session today, and you can start getting the results without the side effects. So folks, I hope you like this episode. Stay healthy, stay awake.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought, or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.